Blind Nil Audio.
Music and money. What are the realities of being a musician? And how do you define enough if your goal in life is to serve the muse? My guests on 50 Fires today, Lucas Nelson and Ben Anderson, come at this question from two very unique vantage points. For Lucas, the son of Willie Nelson, it's about finding self-reliance while still honoring his rich heritage.
I gotta do my own thing. I called my dad, actually, and he said, you know, the best education is the streets. And so I took that to heart, and it seemed to me like a subtle permission to go and find myself.
And for Ben, who is a trial attorney turned music festival organizer, it's all about transforming the music business from the inside out. And of course, money is a huge piece of that puzzle.
Artists are humans, and this whole ecosystem, from the bus driver to the crew person, you name it, right? If we can find a way for artists to still make a good living and to have agents and managers who care about them as persons, we all benefit.
That conversation is up next on 50 Fires. Here's a paradox. We all know people with more money than they will ever need, but they seem to be totally insecure. And on the flip side, we all know people with almost nothing that are completely secure. The conclusion I draw from this paradox is that if you are insecure with money, more money will not solve that problem. I'm Carl Richards, an author, an artist, and a proud financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Lucas Nelson and Ben Anderson. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, "Nothing can bring you peace but yourself." What does this mean as it relates to money? What does it mean to find our own way? I think about this a lot, and after talking to today's guests, it's really been on my mind. Lucas Nelson and Ben Anderson both work in the world of music. Both Lucas and Ben share a sense of admiration and gratitude for those who've supported them on their journeys, fathers, grandfathers, mentors, but they attribute their own success to putting their heads down and just doing the work. First up is my conversation with Lucas, a singer and songwriter whose band is called Promise of the Real. And yes, his dad just happens to be Willie Nelson. So I was surprised when Lucas repeatedly returned to this theme of making it on his own. I was surprised at how important it was to him to be self-sufficient. Because if you want to be a musician and your father is Willie Nelson, there certainly would have been an easier way than the path that Lucas chose. So please enjoy my conversation with Lucas Nelson. So what did they tell you about this conversation?
Nothing.
Okay.
I'm cool. Just ask me questions. I'm an open book.
Well, the goal is really to, I don't know what you were taught growing up, but I was taught never to talk about money
right.
in polite company.
Uh-huh.
And the goal is to change that. And I'm not talking about dollars or budgeting
okay.
apps.
Right.
But like what money actually means.
Right.
So. What were you taught anything about talking about money? Were you told never to talk about it?
I wasn't taught not to talk about it, let's just say.
Yeah.
In fact, my parents were pretty good in terms of teaching me the value of a dollar and all that.
What do you remember from that? Like when you say they were pretty good?
Well, I mean, I learned how to balance a checkbook at a young age, sort of, you know, my mom was super on it about that. And then I sort of separated from my family when I was about 19 or whatever it was, after I left college. And on my own insistence, I decided to cut myself off from any financial teat I might have been suckling from, just because I wanted to be able to have confidence in my own ability to survive in the world without relying on anybody else. It's very important to me for some reason. I don't know why.
Where did that come from, do you think?
I read the book Siddhartha when I was a young kid.
Yeah.
Siddhartha's about a young Brahmin son. And the Brahmins were sort of wealthy spiritual leaders of the time. And so he grew up almost like a prince, but he wanted to understand the world. And then he felt like in order to truly understand the world, he had to go out and experience what it was like to have nothing, experience what it was like to suffer, experience suffering. And then he eventually did that for a while and then experienced the pleasures of desire and all that. You know, he kind of experienced all of the width and breadth of the frequencies of life, right? And then ultimately became the Buddha. And so the story of Siddhartha really touched me because I have an inner desire to find peace and truth. And I think that in order to do that, you have to go through a journey. You have to figure out who you are. And sometimes that means renouncing dependence on anything. Yeah. I wanted to figure out who I was separate from anything else. And so it was a very important spiritual journey for me to go down. And at the same time, I was also on my artistic journey as well. Yeah. So I was busking, I was, you know, sleeping in a car or staying at a friend's house or whatever I was doing, you know, to survive at the time. And I was never completely without. If I wanted to, I could go back. So I've also had that
safety net almost.
You know, and Siddhartha knew he could always go back to his father if he wanted
prodigal son almost.
You know, I wanted to understand who I was separate from anybody else's influence, and being the son of somebody wealthy or famous or whatever,
you know,
you're automatically, you know, you've got a privilege that not many other people have. And so in order to really believe in myself and my ability to accomplish things, I felt like I needed to give myself a handicap and strip myself of that privilege in order to figure out whether I have the right stuff to make it without it, you know. But, you know, I also say that with a caveat because, you know, I did have connections that I wouldn't have had.
Sure.
That, you know, and in that case, I just tried to make the best of those, to work hard, to practice 8-10 hours a day. And I felt like I actually had to work harder in order to prove to myself that I was worthy of a career as an artist, because artists are meant to observe the world around them and be the voice of the world around them, or allow people to relate to them, you know, and all these things that come with having to understand where people are coming from and not just being sort of an aloof.
So do you remember making that choice? Like, was it like, I read the book?
Yeah, no, it came
as
a young,
I'm gonna do this thing.
I always wanted to leave the nest. I always wanted to get away and to just figure out what
it was. Did that come from Maui?
Probably, because in Maui, I grew up with an emphasis on spirituality. I started meditating at a young age. I started.
Are you still?
Yes, meditating? Yes. I do transcendental meditation right now, but it was important for me to figure out who I was at an early age and figure out, you know, I was a swimmer. I was that was my first sort of foray and like passion. And it was like when I watched the Olympics one day and I was like, I want to do that. Right. So before I was a musician, this was when I was eight, nine.
In Maui.
Yep. I wanted to be an Olympic swimmer. Mm. And so I would train 2.5 hours a day and more, you know, and I would study and I realized that to become an Olympic athlete, you just had to dedicate your entire life to it, right? Those guys just give everything to it.
Right.
And when I fell in love with music a couple of years later, I figured I'd apply that same mentality and that same dedication and practice to that, to music. I trained with my guitar, I trained with my songwriting, I trained with my studies, as if I were an Olympic athlete. And I figured that a lot of people would write me off, you know, as the son of. Huh. You know, sometimes, I mean, even when I hear about the son of a musician, I figure, oh, well, maybe they didn't have to work as hard. They didn't, you know, they had things handed to them. They had this and that.
Yeah.
And so as the son of, I realized that. I understood that people would automatically have that reaction. So I figured, well, I better work twice as hard and just so that it you know, I'll never be able to shake that completely, but I will be able to respect myself.
Yeah.
And understand that, you know, whether no one else believes it or not, I worked super hard and continue to work super hard. So that makes me able to sleep at night, you know.
What role, I was super curious to hear about the Buddhist temple next to the school. Like, what role do you think that played in this attachment or non-attachment to
a name
or success or whatever.
After school, every day I'd end school at 2:30, 3 o'clock. And then I'd go walk just next door to this Buddhist temple.
It was literally next door?
It was literally next door.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and these monks would be here and they'd say, come in, and I'd sit and I'd paint these little statues that it was called sutras, little sutras.
Yep.
And I'd sit and then I'd chant with them 2 hours, you know? It was a beautiful sort of calming, relaxing thing. And at that time, I was really exploring what it meant to be human, what it meant to be a conscious being. And so, and in Maui, it was just a perfect environment for me to be exploring that. At the same time, I was exploring my music. And it was all coinciding, you know?
Yeah. What are your earliest memories of money?
Well, when I was young, my parents paid for everything, right? Up until I left high school, and then, you know, the first couple of years of college until I dropped out. And when I dropped out, that was at that moment where I said, you know,
dropped out of high school?
No, I dropped out of college.
Oh, college.
So okay. I was in Loyola Marymount University.
Okay.
So I was in LA.
This was like when you made the same decision.
I made this decision. I got to do my own thing.
Yeah.
I called my dad actually, and he said, you know, the best education is the streets.
Seriously.
So I took that to heart, and it seemed to me like a subtle permission.
Yeah.
To go and find myself. And so I went and I did. And my mom was good about it too. I have good parents.
So, yeah.
You know, I was lucky.
Sounds like it.
I was very, very lucky.
Do you remember money conversations between them or?
So I remember that, it's funny, I didn't really care to be involved with their financial situation. I don't like the idea of a trust or a will. You know, I mean, these things to me bother me.
Why do they bother you?
Because I like knowing that I am a self-sufficient human.
Back to the Siddhartha story.
Yeah, it's not even that. It's just like I find meaning in the ability to take care of myself. I find a strength in that, you know, and I think it would be really make me upset with myself if I even at the expense of living on the street. Like I'd rather live on the street than take that.
Busk.
Yeah, I'd rather do that than I was lucky enough to have connections at the time so where I could take opportunities. And because I'd practiced my art so long, I took advantage of those opportunities and was invited back to play and was invited and people said, oh, well, you know, and even then, you know, still people, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is in my own heart. You know, I know that I'm working as hard as I can.
Yeah.
Almost to the point of exhaustion in some areas.
Yeah.
And then taking care of a band and taking care of, there's a good balance in my life right now, and I'm grateful to my younger self for having the foresight to understand that I wouldn't be happy in any other way.
Yeah, you said I don't want to have to write songs, that whole conversation about the rain.
Yeah.
I don't want to be beholden to anybody. I set that up from a young age.
Yeah.
Is this just this journey, or were there specific things you did?
I understood from learning on my own about finance, learning on my own about contracts that people signed and got screwed, you know, or the idea that when you sign with somebody that you have to, you know, you have to have consistent output of songs, you know, and I never wanted it to become a burden to me. I'd rather make my money playing live than rely on songwriting, because songwriting to me is such a spontaneous event. Mm. It's like an inspiration thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to make it a living means I don't think you can turn it on and off. And so a lot of times when you try and force a song, right, it becomes off as pedantic or whatever. You can tell it was written and formulaically, and it's like the cosmic gift, right?
Right.
And
right.
to just like make it a routine thing, yeah, really seems like
antithetical to the whole
idea. Yeah.
And you knew that early. I mean, like you set things up early so you wouldn't have to be in that situation.
My dad was the greatest influence in songwriting. I think he's one of the great songwriters of our time. And I learned from him and from watching and listening to music since I was a young kid.
The part about the inspiration.
Yeah. Also the idea that he told me a long time ago, never forced to write a song, you know, like Roger Miller said, you got to wait for the rain. You know?
Hey, it's Carl here. It feels important to give you a little bit of context about this part of the conversation with Lucas. Our conversation took place at a songwriters conference held in Park City, Utah. And earlier in the day, before my conversation with Lucas, he had spoken at a panel and he talked about this beautiful concept of the song being like the rain and how he had structured his life to be able to just wait for it to rain. He was told by one of his father's friends, as I recall, that songs are like the rain. You just have to be ready when it comes. So that's what we're talking about here.
Because it was interesting, I was viewing that largely through the inspiration glasses, like the process of creation.
Yeah.
But you're saying that also had an impact on you in terms of how you set up the business side.
Totally. I didn't want to kill the muse.
Where did the lessons come from on the business side? Like you mentioned, like I had people tell me bad contracts, like where?
Yeah, I always tell my young musician friends is that, you know, having a good team around you is the most important thing in the world. You know, you got to be very wary of someone who comes up and says, I'm going to make you a star. that's a dangerous line.
Right.
What I would trust more is somebody that comes and says, I'm going to make you a lot of money. I'm going to make you able to be set for life. I'm going to let you do the creative part because that's what you do best. And I'm going to guide you to have tours that make sense. I'm going to guide you to not overwork yourself so that you can survive in the long term. Mm. I'm not going to send you into the fray like Icarus into the sun. I'm not going to make you, you know, believe that you're more than you are. I'm only going to make you believe that you are who you are and that you should appreciate that. See, my goal in music is not to be famous. It's to be happy, you know,
yeah.
And there's a great disparity there. And I think that I was lucky growing up the way I grew up in seeing all the pitfalls of my father's friends, of people that I saw, knowing famous people, understanding that most of the time, the happy ones are the ones that have the balance in life, not the ones that just threw caution to the wind. I mean, you look at guys like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and those guys. Sure, they became mega famous, but at the cost of their lives. And there are some people that believe that being famous is so great, but really what it is if you don't have the substance behind it, if you don't have your own self-worth intact, then it's going to be like having a dream where you have all this cake and great feast and you go to take a bite and it's not there and you can't taste it. That's the trappings of fame. Mm. You'll be miserable the whole time. You won't enjoy it unless you build yourself first. And so that's, you know, those are all the things that I've learned growing up.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's something I've written a lot about where if you're insecure with money, more money won't solve that problem. I mean, like it's
if you're insecure with anything.
Right.
I mean, honestly.
Problem. Enough is not a number. It's not a destination. It's the only thing you can be now.
Right.
And it actually gets harder to be it if you layer stuff on top. Do you think there's a certain amount of money that establishes the conditions where enoughness can be easier? Or are you like, no?
I mean, look, there's you've got to work to make a living.
Right.
You've got to make money. It's an essential part of life, right? It's important. You got to do it. You got to support yourself. You got to support your family. You got to eat. You know, all these things are. There's necessities in life. And I'm sure that the studies, I don't know what they are now, they used to be with inflation, whatever it is, it's kind of some 80,000 a year, whatever it is that it's easier to be content after a certain amount of money. I know that there's studies that have shown that. But the more successful of us are those who are able to find peace in all situations. Regardless of their surroundings. Like, you know, there are people that have been wrongly imprisoned that find peace in meditation and in studies in prison. And, you know, so it's not the situation, it's how you deal with the situation.
Why do you think we lose track of that so often? I'm curious about from like a singer-songwriter perspective, like why do you think we lose track of that so often? Because everybody's going to nod their head and say, oh, of course. But that's, right. Then we go out in the world, we don't behave that way.
Well, I think that the quick and easy is so attractive. And we live in a society that thrives on quick, easy pleasures, right? We distract ourselves with shows. We distract ourselves with news. We distract ourselves with relationships in some ways, dating apps, all these things. It's so easy. Everything comes so easy. Well, I've got, and yet the easier it gets, the less happy often we are. Now, I think there's a study that says the more choices you have, the less happy you actually are.
Paradox of choice.
Right, yeah. Paradox of choice. So, yeah. And I do think that it's a universal truth that happiness comes from within. At some point, we lost sight of sticks and stones, and the idea that the inner strength, the ability to handle any situation in life is what, as a parent, I would be wanting to instill in my kid. Not to go on a campaign to eradicate all bullies from the planet, the anti-bullying campaign, right? Well, bullies, get rid of the bullies. You shouldn't be bullying. Well, you shouldn't be bullying, but you know what's more important? There are gonna be assholes, kid, and you gotta learn how to deal with it.
Right.
That guy should mean nothing to you. You know, if somebody's bullying you, that means that's their own insecurity, and you should have enough inner strength to not react to it. Learn how to be strong, learn how to be resilient to people's words and not let them affect you. All I'm trying to do is put my head down and work hard, and I feel like that mentality, even the idea of celebrating yourself, is so big in this culture. So, I made it to here. I made it. This is a, 20-year anniversary. Let's do a, celebration, whatever it is. Forget that. In my opinion, what was it Lao Tzu says? Do your work, step back.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about money, success, and art. Because it seems like living the creative life, serving the art. Like, yeah. I think you talked about being like serving the song.
Sure.
Who are you talking about? When you talked about he does a better job than anybody serving the song. Is that your dad or Neil? I think it was Neil.
Well, it was about Neil because Neil has such a wide, and so does Dad, by the way. I could have said it as easy as him, about him. But Neil has so many different genres that he explores.
Yeah.
From trans to the rockabilly record that he did, Shocking Pinks, I think, was the band, to the acoustic stuff, to the grunge, he's the godfather of grunge. But all of it serves the muse, all of it serves the song, all of it serves, if he's going to write, he's just writing what comes, and it serves the song.
Because it seems like so often reality of life, mainly money, gets in the way of that service.
Yeah.
For people. How have you managed that? How you've seen other people manage, because you've done it from a very early age. Like, it's super cool to be able to set things up, really intentionally, work really hard to do it, so that you can just be completely in service and wait for the rain. Just talk to me a little bit about managing that conflict.
I may not have that privilege forever. Now I have it. You know, I could fall into hard times and have to then do something else, right?
Sure.
To survive. As a musician, Neil had a famously hard time with that. Because he signed a record deal with Geffen. And when he wanted to explore his own art and follow the muse, if you will, he got sued for not sounding like himself.
I can't even imagine somebody like you or him, the conversation, like how that must feel.
I got calls from record labels at a younger age. I didn't sign a major deal until like 2016 or something, or 2015. Was when I put my first record deal album out. And that was after I'd been playing for 10 years live. So I really cut my teeth playing live early, but I never was gonna sign a deal that I didn't have complete control over my music. A lot of people at that time wanted me to write, to do country stuff like my dad. Everybody wanted me to do, be Willie Nelson 2.0. And I still, have to push back on that in terms of, if somebody wants me to come and play a bunch of my dad's songs, I say, why don't you hire my dad? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's he's still out there at 90.
That's so great.
You know what I mean? And if you can't get a hold of him, I'm sorry, tough shit. You know what I mean? Like I love playing my dad's songs, but when I want to, and I'm not going to be hired as a surrogate for another artist. I am inspired and grateful to my dad for what I've learned from him. And I play with him. I'm about to play with him tomorrow. But I don't like being expected to do a certain thing with my art, because that's, you get dangerously close to having to ask the muse for too much at that point.
But you've managed, and you know, your thing about Neil being sued for, or not sounding like himself.
Exactly.
How often, it seems like we see so many crushed dreams of artists or creatives because they get stuck with trapping the muse.
Well, because I know how bad it is to have your spirit extinguished by the crushing machine of business. I've seen it firsthand. I know a bunch of artists that are really depressed because they were attracted by the allure of the dollar of fame. And then my band name is literally a mantra to keep me from making those decisions. Mm. Promise of the Real. I named my band Promise of the Real because I wanted to see that on the marquee every day and remind myself of why I do it, the real reason that I play music. Mm. Because it's very easy to get sucked into the temptation of, well, I'm gonna write this because it's trendy, or I'll sign this because it'll give me $2 million, but I'll have to sing this crap for the rest of my life because it's terrible and it's just overproduced that doesn't speak to my soul at all. And then I'm trapped in it, and I can't get out of it maybe for years. And then I'm old, you know what I mean? By the time I get my soul back, it's like, it's too much.
Who are your heroes that have set their lives up this way the best, like creatively, like just in service of the muse?
Paul Simon, my dad, Bob Dylan.
Is it true he never returned the phone call to the Nobel? Do I have this right?
Yeah.
He's like, he didn't even like return?
I think eventually he did, but it's funny,
how good is that?
Yeah, I saw a quote of Leonard Cohen, another one of my favorite songwriters. And Leonard Cohen says, giving Bob Dylan the Nobel Prize is like trying to pin a medal on Mount Everest.
So good.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, congratulations.
So good.
I don't think Bob Dylan ever really thinks about it either. You know what I mean? He's just constantly in service of whatever he's doing in the time. He's putting his head down, doing the work, and stepping back. I respect that.
Amazing. Yeah.
I am obsessed with this concept of enough when it comes to money. How much is enough? Well, everybody seems to have their own answer. But one answer could be that we have enough when we're self-sufficient. When we have the freedom to confidently depend on ourselves to have everything we need in life, maybe that is enough. Think about that as we take a quick break, because when we return, my next guest, Ben Anderson, a trial attorney and musician, will talk to me about his own fascinating journey to finding freedom and enough, and how he's now helping musicians to do the same. 50 Fires, we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, my friends. You are listening to 50 Fires. My next guest is Ben Anderson. Ben is a fascinating guy who is a musician and made his living as a very successful trial attorney. Ben is also the founder of the Park City Song Summit, a music and wellness conference that takes place in my backyard. It's just down the street from where I live. Every September, Ben brings together a diverse group of creative people to Utah to collaborate, celebrate, and bring clarity and normalcy to the struggles musicians, artists, and music lovers alike face around mental health and dependency. It turns out, putting on an event like this is not cheap, and Ben puts his money where his mouth is because he's largely funded the last few years of this event on his own, and that is an important part of this story. So enjoy my conversation with Ben Anderson.
Tell me about, because I know how interested you are in the mental health and wellness, you know, routinely financial stress is ranked among the top one or two causes of adult male suicide, right? It's always ranked in the top, you know, of divorce and anxiety and concern. Like, I've traveled the world the last 10 years talking about money. And when I ask people, large audiences and small, what's the word you would use to describe money? It's been almost routinely anxious or scared. I think you compound that a little bit with somebody who feels as much as most artists do. You know what I mean? Like Lucas was talking about in that thing, like very emotive.
Yep.
So you add like the artist, the emotive, money, the muse.
Yep.
Like what role have you seen money play in the sort of financial health of art? Like what you're trying to do, like what role does finance play? How have you thought about that?
I'm not the greatest business person, I'll be the first to admit it, but I did quite well in my law practice so that I had the ability to start Park City Song Summit with a lot of my own money and be able to then utilize this platform to talk about mental wellness and substance recovery. I would say that the primary reason that I exist at Song Summit is to address the mental wellness of artists who have been caught in the machine of write, record, tour, and they need to feed their families, but they have a large group of people that are they are feel responsible for who all take a piece of the pie. So they make $30,000 on a gig, agent takes a cut, manager takes a cut, got to pay the band, got travel expenses, got insurance, got et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Equipment costs, you name it. And they net out such a small amount. So they have to keep asking for more money at the next one. Well, that person's at that stage. How much are they getting paid? Well, I'm only getting paid this. I'm just as good as they are. So it becomes a rat race. It really does. And the whole ecosystem is at risk, and the whole ecosystem is to blame. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money. They deserve to be paid the value of their art. What I'm concerned is that in trying to do that, they don't have bumpers. They don't have really good life coaches, because I don't mean everyone. There's some really good managers and agents who do care. But in, the agents are part of an agency. The managers are part of a management company. And you better believe they have to look at the bottom line. And so artist wellness hasn't factored into it. It used to be in the old Colonel Parker kind of thing, just keep feeding them with drugs and keep them standing up and get to the next show. You know, and then, you know, get put a shot in for this, a shot in for that, and keep them going, man. Stand up, drugs, sex, rock and roll. We got to make this thing. You're going to be big. It's welcome to the machine. So the 27 Club is not something that people want to be a card-carrying member of. But how many people are in it, right? 27, think about all the beautiful, Neil Young once said when they were asking about needle and the damage done, he was like, heroin alone, you know, put a whole lot of beautiful generations of beautiful creativity in the ground. So who's to blame? At this point in time, it doesn't really matter who's to blame. It's just like we've recognized there's a problem and we know there's a solution. And the solution is treatment. And it's the solution is people being loving and mindful and kind enough to say artists are humans. Their spouses back home and their kids back home are humans. And this whole ecosystem, from the bus driver to the crew person, to the person who's filming it, you name it, right?
without those unsung heroes, that artist didn't understand. And we all love and need music. All right. If we can find a way for artists to still make a good living and to have agents and managers who care about them as persons, if we can capture the discussion about that and we're looking for those in our artists and their touring camps, we're looking for that in us, we take better care of ourselves, we can take better care of musicians and in some way preserve this beautiful thing that we love called music,
yeah.
Right? So we all benefit.
Yeah, it's
we
amazing.
We all benefit if we talk wellness first and music second.
What, you know, I'm really, the purpose of this show, so I've spent the last 20 years of my life just trying to understand the connection between money and meaning and all the struggles that go on around money and then trying to normalize the idea that we're gonna talk about it, right? So I was taught that I could talk with anybody about money as long as they didn't make more or less than me, which left me, right? You know what I mean? In other words, I was taught, we don't talk about money. Is that how you were raised?
No, we didn't have any money, so there wasn't anything to talk about.
Yeah.
But I will say that, so I was raised in a small farm town in Tennessee, which is no longer a small farm town. But it was, at that time, it was a lot of farms, factories, churches, and banks, and football on Friday night, okay? So people just didn't have a lot of money there, and so I would see my parents go through waiting on an unemployment check. And
do you remember watching your parents wait on an unemployment check?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I remember my mom just having a stack of bills and just crying over she wouldn't be able to pay them. And I can remember going to the bathroom. I was a little guy, and I would get one little sheet off the toilet paper roll, and that would be my little Kleenex I'd bring to her. And just like, it's gonna be okay, Mama.
How old were you?
I was seven, eight.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And my dad had, I didn't know this at the time. I didn't realize that he had gone through a lot of serious trauma when he was a young boy. Big time. And so he had, that manifested itself to him being, you know, like he could go from 0 to 60 on the anger scale like that, right? And I think that there was a part of that, as I unpack some of my generational trauma, there's a part of that that was him protecting himself somehow, right? From being a vulnerable little boy who'd been abused and these anger problems he had. And so because of a lot of what was going on with him that was untreated, unpacked trauma, he also didn't have a lot of stability in his job. And my mom didn't either. And she would be a substitute teacher for a while, but then she's trying to be a mom for 4 kids and things. So my granddaddy took care of us a lot. And he would, you know, if it hadn't been for him, we would not have had clothes. We wouldn't have had a lot of things in life, food. And so I saw my parents go through that. And I was a pretty bright kid in school, like straight A's kind of thing, right? And I was always like the president of this class or doing something. And as I look back on that, my mindset was, I am never gonna be poor. I am never going to cry over bills. I am going to do whatever I have to do through my education, through scholarships, and I'm gonna get out of this town. I'm gonna get out from under the weight of unmitigated debt and no path forward financially, because they had none of that. They didn't even have life insurance and things like that.
You say when you look back at it, you said that, but what do you remember? Like, was there a time in your life where you're like, I'm going to get, you consciously remember that?
I remember that. I remember like my granddaddy really just going, son, get the best education you can. You know, his two things he would say is, get a great education to take care of your teeth. That's what he would always say, right?
That's good advice.
And it was, and then my other grandfather, I called him Papa. His thing was like, you're going to be the one that gets out of this.
Wow, like break the chain.
Yeah. And so I guess that was a form of encouragement for sure, but also inspiring me to like, if you want to do this, you got to do it. And you've got to make the grades you know, and you got to take care of yourself, and you're gonna have to get out of this town. In about the eighth grade, I met this guy who was a lawyer, and I didn't know anything about lawyers. All I knew is he had really nice shoes, he wore really nice suits, and he made a lot of money, okay? And my family had always said, and my teachers always said, you're gonna be a lawyer because you argue so well, okay? You get your point across. And you know, we would do debates in school and things like that, and I was always really good at it. So in my mind, I argue well, and I need to get out of this thing, and lawyers make a lot of money. So I put together this survival escapism, like I can get out of here and I can do well if I, but they always say, but it takes really good grades to be a lawyer, right? And I knew it took good grades.
Hey, it's Carl. I'm gonna fill in some gaps here because I was not expecting what Ben's about to say. Yes, he met a lawyer in eighth grade that showed him how he could move beyond his childhood home and environment. But shortly thereafter, when he was in high school, he was introduced to someone who would shape his life in a way that he could have never expected. He met Al Gore, the future vice president of the United States, who at the time of this story was a senator in Tennessee. And he liked Ben, and I'll let him tell you the rest of the story.
So by the eighth grade, I was like, I want to be a lawyer. And my old girlfriend in high school, her dad knew Al's dad, and he knew Al. And so I didn't have a strong male figure that had gone to college, graduated, much less an advanced degree beyond that, or financially secure or in business that I could learn from. So Al Gore was really cool. He would meet with me during my junior year of high school and senior year of high school. Anytime he would be in town, I'd go meet with him. And he became like this mentor slash counselor for me. Took a liking to me, I guess. I don't know.
Wow.
And he helped me, like, he said, well, if you would like to apply for one of the academies, you know, do that. And if you score high enough, you know, you'll be ranked. And then I'll be able to choose the top four to go to one of the four academies. But I encourage you also to apply for like an ROTC scholarship. So if you're thinking about going that route. And so, it came down to the point where I had scored high enough and I got a Naval ROTC scholarship, 4-year scholarship for Vanderbilt. Somehow, by the grace of God, I did make it through law school. So yeah, man, I was not so great my first year or so. And then the second year, I found what my true love was, which arguing, which was trial advocacy.
Yeah.
Then I started to hit my stride. I was on the trial team. I'm like, oh, this is why I went to law school. I hated the practice of law. I liked the practice of going to trial. And then I finally got a real job with a good firm and started making money, started paying those student loans back. And I'm like, okay, finally. And I started to climb the scale of, you know, being in law firms, and that dream of being able to use whatever innate ability I had to argue or to present a position and making money. Hey, funny, from my little eighth grade in 1978 to when 1993, '95, something like that. Yeah, you know, it was a long journey, but I finally got there and then started to feel some financial stability at that point in time.
That's amazing.
But I also went from being a very, very, very busy trial lawyer, going all over the country trying cases, experts all over the world, blah, 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 right? And gone away from my family so much. And my mental health, even though I was many years in recovery when I started my last case, standing in front of a board going, I can't remember what city I'm in. I don't remember what city I'm going to. And going, dude, you gotta make some changes. So I did that. It was like, okay, I'm gonna retire from the courtroom. I had my mic drop case that I was able to walk away from and go, okay, I'm good financially. But I was exhausted.
How much of that was driven out of this need to never have to worry about money again?
Well, I'm a deeply competitive person. And I always thought I could win and should win and wanted to win. That's the definition of a competitor,
yeah.
To a fault, maybe.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's gotta be a winner and a loser in a courtroom, right? And I'd be damned if I was gonna let whoever this other counsel was on the other side, who I, you know, sort of convinced myself that I was, the truth, you know, weighed in my favor, not theirs, or else I wouldn't have taken the case. So highly competitive in the courtroom. And that as you garner success in that ladder climbing of like, oh, he's a pretty good trial lawyer, like he's a gunslinger, whatever, then more people want you to try their cases or to be involved, right?
Yeah.
Once I got to that point of being a mass tort trial lawyer who had a record verdict against Johnson & Johnson in this particular largest medical device case in history, I was like, you know what?
Hi, Carl again. The case that Ben just referenced, well, it was settled in 2017. And the verdict, which included a $17.5 million punitive damage award for his client against Johnson & Johnson, that was indeed one of the largest medical device cases in history when it was settled.
I was like, you know what? For the top of the trial lawyer mountain, I got there.
Yeah.
I was good. And when I got there, I thought that it would be like, hey, and it, instead
everything's
of that,
fine now.
Everything's fine now, right?
Yeah.
Financially, I was, but spiritually, I wasn't.
Still wasn't there.
Right?
It's so interesting, don't you think? Because like there's a double whammy going on. Like you've somehow convinced yourself, whether you were taught or the society taught you, somehow convinced yourself that everything would be okay when.
Sure.
I mean, it's so silly now. Like we look at that statement like, of course not. But when you're in the middle of it, like everything would be okay when you get there. And not only is it not okay, it's arguably the disappointment of it not being okay makes it worse.
Well, you know what's fascinating is the is how analogous that is to recovery.
Interesting. So, tell me about that.
Well, so for me, we have this thing in recovery, or a lot of people do, and that's if only fill in the blank.
I'll be happy when.
Yep. Mm. If only that person would stay off my back. If only my boss would be cool. If only my wife would quit yelling at me when I've been out drinking with the guys. If only this, right? And it was like always blaming someone else and never being present or accountable for my own actions, words, and deeds, right? So what I found out is that I was always going to be hollow because I was always like, if I could just, it's the grass is greener, right? There's a reason that thing's still, that adage is still around, right? Because it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You always think, oh man, look at that dude's house. I mean, mine's nice, but look at that. Look at that car. Well, if I work a few more cases, I can have a jet too. My buddies have jets.
Yeah.
Why don't I have a jet, right?
Yeah.
I guess the point being that with recovery, I realized to be very, very satisfied with who I am, where I am, what I've achieved.
Independent of external circumstances.
Without regard to material
possessions. It's interesting. We just, Lucas was here earlier and we were having this exact conversation that if you're a miserable son of a bitch around money, more money will not solve that problem.
That's right.
Like if you're insecure, money will not solve. If you're insecure with money, more money will not solve that problem.
Yeah, when people say money changed him, I always say no.
It just amplified.
It just amplified. It just gave him more reason to be an asshole.
Yeah.
If someone is really, really kind and they get more money, guess what?
Generally,
they become more kind. Generally. There's exceptions to all rules, but what I've seen is that the people that I've known that garnered a large amount of wealth, if they were cool people, they're good people, they stay good people, they just have more money.
Why do you think it's so hard for us to believe? Like I know you know now, but if I tried to tell you that 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it would have been like a cute story, like cute with, mm-hmm. your little fairy tale. Like, why is that so hard to believe?
I don't know, man.
All the research is there, all the folklore, all the wisdom traditions. They've been pointing this forever.
Well, it wouldn't happen to me.
I can be the exception. I want to try that problem.
It's called defensive attribution, right?
Mm.
It was like in trial lawyer, and you talk about like, let's say it was a medical malpractice case. Defensive attribution is the person on the jury who was like, well, I would have gotten a third opinion. No, they wouldn't have.
Hmm.
So they hold the plaintiff to a higher standard than what their own behavior pattern would have borne out.
Hmm.
Oh, she should have known that tumor was cancerous. Okay, really? And so people tend to see the worst in others and not compare it to what probably is something that they have themselves, which is you would have gone to your doctor, trusted your doctor. If they said there's nothing wrong, you would have believed it. If you sit on a jury and you're hearing that story from someone else, you're like, I can't believe she didn't ask three more doctors about this. And so I think that we never like to think that it'll happen to us. It's the whole thing, right? It's like if you're you know, you're going to a place that you know it's hurricane season, and you're like, eh, it probably won't happen to me. You know, we just don't like to think that we are dumb enough or ignorant enough in the truest sense of the word to put ourselves in a bad situation, because we would have made a different decision, right? So I think that happens with money. Like, if I ever got money, I'd take care of everything. You know, they talk about people that win the lottery, and some of them end up doing just fine, and some of them are bankrupt.
Almost 90% of them are bankrupt. Like, it's not a good
right. Yeah. And so a lot of the folks already had issues that were untreated or unpacked or whatever, and not unpacked, and the money just escalated things real quickly.
Yeah,
they found out what their true self was.
Totally, it's interesting if you can like have enough and still want to push, you know, like be content and still be creative. Of course we can, right? But it's interesting to not get those two conflated in
it
our heads
is
sometimes.
Absolutely in conflict, and it's something that I have to be wary of, because one of my character challenges is not letting that impetus that I had that was the genesis of getting out of unattainable and getting out of a particular socioeconomic status to not then go. It's just like I was saying a few minutes ago, the mass tort business. It's like, I got this plane, oh, his plane's bigger than your plane, or I got this house, now my house is bigger. It's very easy to fall into the trap unconsciously.
For sure.
Because it's the competitive thing and making a little more money. That's why I had to get off of that gerbil wheel. It was of mass tort, because there's always that next case. Oh, and this one's going to be even bigger. Hey, who's getting around this one? Oh, let's put in a few $1 million and figure out and do some research, see if this is the bigger one. They're always chasing the next big mass tort, which is like a class action, right? And I realized, like,
right,
you take in debt to be able to do this case, and it takes 5 years to win the case or settle the case, and then it takes 5 years to get the money in. So that means you got to borrow enough to be able to go out and grab those next 5 years of cases and da-da-da. And it's a death spiral. Most of them call it a business model. I call it a death spiral,
right?
Because it just eats you up.
Yeah.
So I got out of that into the music industry.
Right, right. Perfect. That's perfect. As I've been reflecting on these conversations with Lucas and Ben, I've been thinking about Lucas mentioning Siddhartha, because that book is basically the story of a young, wealthy prince who decides to renounce everything about his old life so that he can find his way on his own. It's a collection of profound universal lessons of Siddhartha on his way to becoming the Buddha. And one of the quotes that I love from that book is this: I've always believed, and still believe, that whatever good or bad fortune may come our way, we can always give it meaning and transform it into something of value. That certainly holds true for both of my guests. And I'd venture to say that it's true for every one of us in our own way. So with your permission, I'd love to just make a suggestion, something to reflect on. It's something I'm going to do over the next couple of weeks after listening to this conversation. It turns out that whether you're the son of a prince or you were raised in relative poverty, the thing that actually matters is that we find our own way. It turns out that's hard because we are bombarded all day by stories about how other people do it. We're told by our parents, our friends, our family members about how maybe we should do it. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be more intentional about what messages I let into my life about what is enough for me. What does it mean to carve my own path? What does it mean to do my thing? And I would invite you to do the same. Cheers, my friends. Thanks for joining me today, and I'll see you around the next fire. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio. If you find this show valuable, would you do me a favor? Share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nail Audio, nor Magnolia.